Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back. We are America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin, along with my partner, John Krofcik. And John, I saw something in our local newspaper, Unmasking the Drone, author to discuss good and bad of Sky Sentinel. So you know what I did, John? I went on a road trip.
You bought a drone.
No, I'm going to drone on during this podcast. No, honestly, I went and I took a road trip on our behalf, John, just to scout out, to make certain this was the right person to discuss this very interesting topic about drones, because we're not only talking about civilian uses, but also military uses.
Oh, the police?
Absolutely. How police can use it. What are the limitations? We talked in a recent podcast about privacy. Well, drones certainly can have an impact on your privacy when your neighbor is flying it right around your bedroom in the middle of the night. I found Dan Gettinger, John, and he is the founder and co-director of the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College. I bet you didn't even know that Bard College was looking at drones.
I didn't. I didn't know you could study drones.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we all thought about it recently. We had that drone strike on that Iranian general, Soleimani,
and that
crystallized a lot of our thinking about this. But drones are a remarkable achievement, John. But I will really startle you when I tell you that we're going to be talking about Marilyn Monroe.
Really?
In this podcast.
She had a drone?
She worked in a factory that created drones. So drones are nothing new. They've been around for a long time. Now, they've become smaller, more agile, used for different purposes, of course. But nonetheless, they've been around a long time. So we get into the history of the drone, and then we find out where we are today in terms of its uses and applications, both militarily and otherwise. And we talk about all kinds of versions of them. I mean, you can have some very large drones, John, very small ones.
Yeah, you know, the other ones they use in the military, some of them are almost the size of an aircraft.
Exactly. Well, what kind of role can they play to be a wing person, man or woman? I don't know, these drones, I don't think they have any sexual orientation. But nonetheless, they are really being put to use in many different ways by many different countries. The United States has been very effective in developing drone technology. There are whole industries built up. I was just reading a really interesting article, drone testing site lifts industry. And we're looking at Rome, New York, John, upstate New York. And they were, this airport, Griffiths, once a cornerstone of Cold War deterrence, and now they have something smaller that's taking flight over their runways, the next generation of drones. So they're lifting an entire economy in upstate New York. There's lots of activity in this area. You know, another country that's been very involved in this is Israel.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're doing work. I mean, they're doing some brilliant work over there, so I don't doubt it.
Well, there's lots to discuss about drones. I mean, do we need a permit to fly them? How high and how fast and how far can they go? What are the various, you know, uses that are most applicable to what the technology presently can do? But whatever it can do today, it will be surpassed tenfold in the next 10, 15 years.
Well, I've seen some beautiful photography from drones. I mean, you can really get some nice shots, beautiful. So I mean, there's a lot of good stuff you can do with drones, but there's a lot of bad stuff too with any technology.
Well, we're going to talk about all of it today. Civilian, military, it's all on our agenda. We're talking drones on America Trends.
With me on the line on America Trends is Dan Gettinger, and he's the founder and co-director for the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College. Now, you and another college friend got together, were fascinated by this technology, and you decided to start a whole center to study it. Explain this to us.
Yeah, that's right. Back in 2012, my colleague Arthur Hall and Michelle and I were seniors at Bard College, and we were really interested in drones and in drones in warfare, drones in commercial for commercial purposes. Back at that time, there was effort to authorize the Federal Aviation Administration to begin drafting regulations for drones, and we thought that this was going to sort of unleash this big drone industry, or you know, at least have a major effect back at home. And so we wanted to create this institution, the center, that was interested in all forms of unmanned systems technology, whether for military purposes or civilian purposes, and explore the issues that are associated with that technology.
And how major of an industry is it becoming in the United States and around the world?
It's a pretty major industry. I mean, I think that when the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, was starting out, they predicted around 30,000 commercial drones by 2020, I believe. And we have, I think over 400,000 commercial drones registered today, and over 1.3 million recreational drones registered today. So it's a pretty major industry. I mean, I think there are a lot of industries that didn't think about how drones could be useful for them a couple of years ago, and then found that there are many ways that they could use drones, whether that's for, you know, inspecting infrastructure, inspecting utility infrastructure, or for filming, for photography. So there's a lot of drone industries, a lot of different businesses that aren't associated with aviation at all, but drones gave them that aerial capability that they didn't know that would be useful for them.
And are we looking at growth primarily in the civilian sector, in the military sector? Where are we seeing the most activity in terms of research and development?
Well, I think there remains a lot of activity in the military sector, both in the United States and abroad. The U.S. is not the only, developer or user of military drones. There are many countries that have their own, you know, domestic drone production lines. So I don't know. It'd be a little hard to say which was, you know, larger, the civilian or the military industry. I think there's a lot happening both in the civilian and military sectors. And there are some intersections, such as artificial intelligence and autonomy, that have applicability for both civilian and military users.
And are the same companies involved in the military application and the civilian, or are they different industries in terms of the companies that are involved in one or the other?
They're largely different now, and traditionally they have been different. The military sector is dominated by, defense contractors. The largest defense contractors that work for, other sectors of military hardware. There is some emerging commonality in, as I said, artificial intelligence, autonomy, you know, these sort of next generation technologies that have a lot of applicability for civilian users, but also for military users. And in the military, there's a push to sort of replicate the success that personal drones, consumer drones have had in the civilian sector. So a lot of the military drones are very expensive. They're pretty large. And there's a push now to find cheaper, smaller quadcopter drones that are so popular among civilian users. So I'd say that, traditionally there's been a lot of difference in how the military and how the civilian industries look at drones, but I'd say that there's increasing number of intersections. Another area is cargo drones. And so, you look at in the civilian space, we're really interested in drone deliveries and, you know, how, when and how are we going to get products delivered to our home. The military is also interested in drone deliveries and sort of supplying remote troops using drones as opposed to using manned convoys. So there are definitely intersections, but you know, traditionally it's been pretty separate.
Well, why don't we back up a little bit, and I should have done this at the outset. What is a drone? I mean, at its simplest, and, you know, when we look at the convergence between the various uses, but what are the common characteristics of these unmanned aerial vehicles or whatever they are called? And give us some of the names and some of the terms in case people are looking at various documents about them and they may be typified as one thing or another.
Yeah, there are a lot of names for drones, and there's always been a debate about what to call these things. You know, these drones have been around for some time, you know, since before the Second World War, but you know, they've taken various forms, and so essentially, a drone is a uninhabited, uncrewed vehicle, and that vehicle could be operated remotely by somebody on the ground or in the air, or that vehicle could operate semi-autonomously or autonomously. So it could have very little human interaction and could be able to operate, you know, pretty much on its own. But essentially, a drone is an uncrewed vehicle. Our concept of a drone, I mean, we cover all types of unmanned systems, as they're called. We cover unmanned systems in the air, aerial systems, we cover unmanned systems on the ground, sometimes referred to robots, and we cover unmanned systems in the sea. These are sometimes called unmanned undersea vehicles, so like mini submarines, or they could be called unmanned surface vehicles, so boats that are uncrewed. Different military services have different names for drones. So for example, the Air Force calls their larger unmanned vehicles, they call them remotely piloted aircraft, RPAs. The Army calls very similar aircraft unmanned aerial systems, or UAS. The FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, usually calls drones UAS, unmanned aerial systems, and that's sort of the term du jour of the entire government. So you'll hear UAS named a lot. But, you know, other countries have their own names and acronyms for drones. In Europe, it's very typical to hear drones be called remotely piloted aircraft systems, RPAS. In Israel, there are RPAVs, remotely piloted aircraft vehicles. So there's a lot of variation.
Okay, well, you've given us a lot to remember there. We're still going to call them drones for the purpose of this conversation.
That's fine. That's what we do, too. So.
And I know that they can be light, they can be medium, they can be heavy. So the whole idea of something that is small, hovering above us, I mean, these can be the size of a 737, correct?
The larger military drones are, yes, the size of a 737, the Global Hawk. So again, there's a lot of variation in what a drone is, and that's some part of the challenge of defining these systems, because the technology is evolving, and the drones of today may look very different, or the drones of tomorrow may look very different than the drones of today. So yeah, I mean, you know, again, we are the Center for the Study of the Drone, and our remit covers all types of vehicles, whether they're, you know, small consumer drones or large, you know, military drones.
Before we dig into where they have been most prominent in the news of late, let's just go back, because I know there's a curiosity in the history of the drone. I mean, the origins go back to the First World War, but in World War II, Marilyn Monroe, some people say she was discovered as a result of being involved in a plant that made drones. So just to get that on the table, because I think a lot of people will find that interesting.
Yeah, it's a funny story. Marilyn Monroe was working at a plant for a company called Radioplane, and Radioplane produced these aircraft that would look very familiar to remote control aircraft hobbyists today. They were basically wooden planes controlled remotely, for target practice. And so they would be used, they would be flown basically shot down as a way to improve the accuracy of gunners, artillery gunners. She was working at this factory before she was well known. An Army photographer came along and took a picture, and the rest is history.
Absolutely. Now, I know that drones would also be flown into these atomic mushroom clouds in the 40s, and then we go into Vietnam, and they were involved in reconnaissance. And then we get to the modern era, per se, and go into the U.S. and Israel really being leaders in fashioning the use of this technology. And what is the concept for the military? Is it because it's faster, lighter, more mobile? Is it because we can assure ourselves of fewer deaths on the battlefield? What is it that we were looking for in the use of these drones?
They're definitely not faster, or at least most drones aren't faster than manned aircraft. Actually, the utility that a lot of military planners saw in them was because they were slower, and they could fly slowly over the battlefield and collect a lot of intelligence, and for longer periods of time than an aircraft crewed by a human being might be able to fly for. In the early days and today, they are really seen as the eyes of the Army. They conduct reconnaissance and surveillance. So they were really seen as a way to do the, quote unquote, dull, dirty, and dangerous work, that a human wouldn't have to do. And instead a drone could do that. And so, yeah, absolutely. Because they were, because they are unmanned, uncrewed, they didn't put human beings at the same risk of being shot down.
Dan Gettinger is with us, co-director of the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College. And Dan, a lot of people go back to February 4th, 2002, the Predator drone strike in Afghanistan intended to hit Osama bin Laden. And we have thought about the drone a lot as it relates to this asymmetrical warfare that America has been involved with. And, the use of the drone, lots of people saying that during the presidency of Barack Obama, it was used a lot. And then, of course, most celebrated, I guess, of late was the drone strike on the Iranian general Soleimani. So take us through some of that military history and the use of the drone.
Yeah, so the U.S. military started to arm the drone arm the Predator drone in 2000, and it was actually one of the first aircraft to launch strikes in Afghanistan after 9/11. Since then, there have been progressively more drones that have been armed. And as you say, that during the presidency of Barack Obama, there was this problem where a lot of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda elements that were in Afghanistan had fled to Pakistan. And at the same time, there was a growing Al-Qaeda problem in Yemen and in Somalia. And so as a solution to this problem, as a way to avoid risk to human pilots or to ground troops, the Obama administration turned to drones and launched a major campaign, what has been called the Targeted Killing Campaign, basically to target the leaders and members of these Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. That campaign has since pretty much come to an end in Pakistan, but it remains active in places like Yemen and Somalia. Just recently, we had a drone strike targeting members of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Yes, yes, I think we all read about that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so the drone was seen as this useful tool for pursuing members of Al-Qaeda, and there has since been a lot of debate about how many about the civilian casualties as a result of these strikes, and whether it was legal under international law to use drones in these ways. So they suddenly opened up that type of use certainly opened up a lot of issues that hadn't really been thought about much before.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
By the way, the Gulf War, I know, was the first time that soldiers actually surrendered to a drone, Iraqi soldiers, to an American drone. So for those of you who are fascinated by firsts in military history, what about the humans who are involved in making certain, because you said some are autonomous, but of course there are many pilots, if you will. Talk about the training that they have, where they are, and the impacts on them, because I've read where PTSD is even a factor for some of these pilots who are remotely controlling these vehicles, knowing of the impact they're having, even though they may be a world away.
Almost all drones in use today are piloted by somebody somewhere, and it could be 10 miles away. It could be 1,000 miles away, or more. So the drones of the Air Force, like the Reaper and the Global Hawk, are definitely piloted, and these pilots have to go through very rigorous training. They are certified to fly aircraft before they begin their training to pilot drones. And so initially there was, most of the people that piloted drones were former, cargo plane, they were all military pilots, but they maybe flew fighter jets they flew cargo planes before, and they transferred over. And then gradually more and more pilots that entered into the service that were designated specifically for flying drones. And there has been research that has been done into the psychological effects of flying drones. I mean, it is a very challenging job, even though these pilots are not deployed overseas necessarily. It remains a challenging job because of the long hours and simply the type of work that they're doing, does have effects. And I think our concept of PTSD, of trauma from conflict, has definitely evolved over the years, from shell shock in World War I to the current day concept of PTSD, and gradually that concept has included people who are not necessarily physically present for the for the trauma, but may witness the trauma remotely. And drone pilots, they have to fly over the area long after the strike has taken place, and so that those experiences could have lingering effects.
Now, you have been quoted as saying that drones are a technological achievement, but in a military circumstance, they don't operate in a vacuum. And you say that a lot of the challenges going forward for the U.S. will be in the way that this system, designed for low-intensity conflicts like in Afghanistan and Iraq, can be repurposed for high-intensity conflicts with China or Russia. I mean, how high stakes is this drone development as we look at another conflagration, let's say, of major powers? What role could they play today, or what role is envisioned for them?
Drones were designed for a specific type of conflicts, and they've certainly proved very valuable in the types of conflict that we've engaged in over the past two decades, in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, where the U.S. doesn't really have to concern itself with any significant threat to its aircraft from enemy air defenses. The Taliban don't have a very robust air defense program, But, you know, as the U.S. Sort of repositions itself to prepare for potentially conflict against near-peer competitors like Russia and China, those countries certainly do have very robust air defense capabilities. You know, countries like Iran as well, as we've seen demonstrated in the past year, also has those capabilities when they, you know, they shut down a U.S. surveillance drone last August, I believe, last summer. And so so the U.S. military is definitely thinking about, you know, how drones could evolve for this this next generation of conflict. And, you know, it could be that drones take on a greater number of roles. It could be that, you know, the image of the drone becomes, you know, the physical characteristics of the drone change to make it faster, more autonomous, more stealthier, mm-hmm. In order to be able to compete with Russia and China. So, you know, I think there will always, and for a lot of countries, there will be a demand for the type of drones that that the U.S. has used. So I don't see the drone going away anytime soon. But, you know, the drone, you know, as many other types of technology, is definitely going to evolve. You know, the helicopter has certainly evolved from, you know, from its early stages to today. And like other types of aircraft and military technology, the drone will also change.
Well, about 97 countries, I believe, in your data book are active with inventories. You've said that 60 or more have active R&D programs. And what are most trying to do? I know the U.S. and Israel have been leaders in this era of the modern drone. But are we now looking at counter-drone technology? Are we looking at trying to make the drone a better loyal wingman to manned flight? What do you think the most energy and the most money is going into right now?
There's definitely a lot of interest in counter-drone technologies and capabilities. You know, that's something that that we thought a lot about. We put out two reports on the counter-drone market and sort of finding all the different types of counter-drone systems out there and how they work and providing a guide to that. In our last report, we found, which was done by my colleague, Arthur Holland-Michelle, we found over 500 different types of counter-drone systems on the market. So there's definitely an interest and demand for the ability to shoot down drones or at least impede their progress, both in the civilian and the military space. And then, you know, I think, yeah, as you mentioned, manned-unmanned teaming, which is the process by which a drone is partnered with a manned aircraft. So as opposed to being piloted on the ground, the drone operates alongside of, is either piloted by or flies, you know, semi-autonomously alongside of a manned aircraft and acts as that wingman, an unmanned wingman, to that manned aircraft. And the drone may do different things like conduct surveillance and reconnaissance or target enemy air defenses. So you know, in terms of research and development efforts, I'd say, you know, there are a lot of efforts to develop all types of drones, not just wingmen, you know, but the types of drones mm-hmm. that we've seen in operation for decades. So a lot of countries are interested in developing their own drone programs because the majority rely on imports from other countries like the U.S. and China and Israel. But you know, there are efforts to develop drones that are smaller, that are faster, that are designed to perhaps operate in swarms or operate in tandem with unmanned vehicles on the ground or in the sea. And so, you know, all of these efforts are looking towards, yeah, the next generation of drones.
You know, we talked about asymmetrical war, where you can be fighting really an enemy that you don't know is an enemy. They may look like civilians. They're not dressed in the way that another military might. And America has traditionally been trained to fight a conventional war. But what does the drone do to even out the playing field or even give us the advantage because we are technologically so sophisticated in this realm? And because the cost to us is bloodless, or at least less bloody. So what is the impact of that? I know a lot of people have imagined the future, Dan, in terms of, you know, what it looks like when, you know, you've got robots fighting each other. And in some sense, this is what we're talking about. What does this do on the battlefield?
You know, I think from a military perspective, it gives commanders more time to try to understand, you know, is this the correct target? You know, is this the correct time to take, you know, to attack this target? So I think that's the value that a lot of military commanders see in the drone, is that, you know, it's a manned aircraft. They have a very limited window in which they are able to strike a military target or to strike a target. And whereas with the drone, you can, you know, enlarge that window because the drone is slower and they are able to loiter over that battlefield. You know, I'd say that's the value that that military planners see. And then, you know, I think there's definitely, yeah, a reduced human cost in the sense that from the military's perspective that they don't need to put as many people in harm's way. But, you know, there still is a large human footprint to operating drones. You know, you need to have people on the ground to maintain the aircraft, and you need to have this huge network of people to analyze the imagery from drones.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let me get back to civilian use for a moment. A lot of people who might be listening to this are wondering, you know, what are the applications that we are now seeing and will see? Everybody's heard about Amazon suggesting that they are going to be dropping off our packages via a drone. Everybody has seen the recreational drones taking pictures of soccer games or whatever it might be. There are concerns about privacy laws and public safety laws for drone use, and I know that's governed state by state. But what trend do you see in this particular realm? Are we going to see the FAA getting more involved in regulation and you know, various new uses that we can't even imagine today?
Well, the big debate or issue at the moment is an issue called remote identification or remote ID. And that is an proposed FAA regulation whereby each drone would have a sort of license plate that could be read from the ground, similar to, you know, vehicles or aircraft. You know, aircraft have their own identification beacon that air control is used to manage the airspace. And so drones at the moment, drones are required to have an identification number, but they don't have a sort of electronic beacon that can be read and tracked. And so when somebody sees a drone flying in the air below, you know, above them, they don't know who that drone belongs to or what it's doing. And so this would provide that tool for regulators, for law enforcement, for air traffic managers to be able to track and manage drones. So this, in theory, would enable a number of operations that the FAA has to date, either outright prohibited or restricted, or, you know, allowed only under certain conditions. And, you know, these are operations like long-range drone operation, drone flights, or drone operations over people or over vehicles. You know, these types of operations are severely restricted at the moment, but the theory is that if the FAA was able to track these drones, you know, we could see things like drone deliveries happening, or we could see drones being used for long-range inspections of pipelines or for long-range cargo delivery. You know, these more complex types of operations that we see manned aircraft doing, you know, we could envision at one point. You know, a lot of people think about drone deliveries as small drones, but, you know, we could see larger drones replacing manned aircraft adding to the capabilities of manned aircraft, you know, supplying remote areas in Alaska or remote parts of the country.
Well, what about those who are worried about surveillance and privacy laws, not only by your neighbor, but by your local, you know, police force? Because we know that we have cameras and surveillance now on street corners across America. In England, you can't go on a street corner without that. What about those that can fly above? Because I know that the video imaging from these continues to get more sophisticated as we go along?
Yeah, I mean, drones are a data collection platform, and like a lot of other data collection platforms, there is a risk to privacy, so there, you know, questions like how the data is collected, what types of data are being collected, how the data is stored, and for how long, are really important questions. Whether that's a company that's using a drone or a government agency using a drone. So as drones become more sophisticated, these questions are certainly going to become a lot more prominent. So I'd say right now, you know, we track the number of public safety agencies using drones and how they're using them, and we don't see too much risk of surveillance today. But like other types of video imaging technologies, like body-worn cameras, or as you mentioned, like street cameras, surveillance cameras, CCTV cameras, you know, these drones should be viewed in this family of systems that warrant some greater examination and perhaps regulation. Some states have already regulated around this issue, and so you know, I wouldn't say, you know, drones are unique in that, unlike CCTV cameras, they can fly and they can fly around and sort of be more perhaps intrusive than a camera on the ground. But, you know, they're still a data collection platform, and so they should be seen as such.
What about airspace limits? Are we hearing much from commercial pilots that, just like the bird issues, that now drones that fly, 400 feet and below, that they're causing problems around airports, or is that not an issue?
It's an issue. It's a bit debated, you know, how big of an issue it is. I think there are a number of pilots that would say, you know, that this is definitely a severe issue. There have been a number of incidents involving drones and manned aircraft already. I think a lot of, on the other end of the spectrum, I think a lot of hobbyists would say, you know, it's overblown. You know, it's not as big of an issue as it's perceived to be. You know, there's a number of bad actors, of course, there always will be, but you know, it's not as severe as some people perceive. So I think there's truth to both those points. I would think that, you know, there's definitely an issue with drones in that they are operating in a space that's shared with others. And, you know, in a lot of places where drone operators live, you know, there can be a lot of types of activity happening in there, whether it's helicopters or commercial airliners. So, you know, I think there's definitely an airspace issue there, and you know, that's part of what the FAA is working on solving, and sort of segregating the airspace and providing rules for drone users.
Well, I'm wondering at your center if you've looked at, societies that are more totalitarian than ours, because I was just reading about the Chinese, and you have drones scolding Chinese residents without masks as the coronavirus spreads. And here in this article, yes, Auntie, this is the drone speaking to you. You shouldn't walk around without wearing a mask. And then it says Chinese military and government agencies have been known to use drones to surveil their citizens since at least 2016, especially in the western part of China, where they have Muslims that they are imprisoning. Drones are also used to enforce traffic laws and for other police work. Is this something becoming more prevalent in totalitarian societies?
It's a little hard to say, you know, how prevalent it is, simply because there's a number of anecdotal, you know, cases in which people have noticed drones being used in China. It's hard to say whether, you know, how prevalent drone use is for surveillance.
Imagine that if society wants more control, that these particular technological wonders certainly could be used in that process. And we're seeing they can be used for good purposes, too, in terms of sending out alerts and letting people know that there may be a warning or a hazard or a chemical spill or whatever it might be. I'm just wondering, because I heard you speak earlier, and you had said that they can be used to reduce tensions as well in a military sense. And then there are some, and we'll close with this, who wonder whether drones could actually have any role in starting another world conflict. I mean, are we more likely to see them being used to de-escalate or escalate conflict going forward?
I think we're more likely to see drones being used in places that have historically had a number of geopolitical tensions, you know, places like the Persian Gulf, places like the South China Sea and East China Sea, the India-Pakistan border, India-China border, in Ukraine. You know, these places are areas where there already is a lot of drone activity, and we're likely to see more in the future. You know, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say as that activity will lead to an increase in tensions, but you know, I think it will certainly make efforts, activity in those spaces a lot more complicated. And so, you know, a couple of years ago, there was an issue where China actually captured or caught a U.S. underwater drone. And there was some, debate over, you know, whether they would return it or whether they would use that technology. And so, you know, as drones continue to and increase operations in these areas, you know, we could have more, run-ins with other countries. And, you know, it's a little hard to see how all of those incidents will play out as we've seen over the past year.
Really interesting. Dan Gettinger, the co-director and founder of the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College. By the way, if somebody wants to get your books, remind them how they are available and what they focus on.
Yeah, all of our reports and products are available for free online on our website, which is dronecenter.bard.edu. You can also email us at csd@bard.edu. We're happy to help.
All right. Dan, thank you so much for giving us a really interesting look into the world of drones. And I think anybody who's listened to this now understands a whole lot more about them than they did 30 minutes ago. Thanks again for being part of America Trends.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.